Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. Clinical trials are a key research tool for advancing medical knowledge and setting the standards for patient care. Through well-designed studies, physicians and researchers are able to test which treatments are safe and effective. Most medical treatments today are the result of well-designed clinical trials. Our next guest is one of the top clinical researchers, not only in the U.S., but in the world, especially in the field of preventive medicine and women's health.
Dr. Joanne Manson is a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's also professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and chief of the Division of Preventive Medicine in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Manson's passion for public health has led her to dedicate her career to investigating how nutrition and lifestyle modifications can improve personal health and help people to live longer, healthier lives. She shared her expertise previously on Take Care and joins us once again today to discuss her current research and those findings that show the most promise for the future.
Dr. Manson, thank you so much for coming on Take Care once again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So your focus is public health, and you study how changes in diet and lifestyle choices can improve health and well-being. So what are you currently working on that the rest of us will benefit from in a few years?
Well, we're currently doing two large-scale randomized clinical trials. One is of vitamin D and the omega-3 fatty acids or fish oil in a trial called the Vitamin D and Omega-3 Trial, VITAL. And this trial includes 26,000 men and women nationwide, and we're getting close to completion of the trial. We are going to continue the intervention, randomized treatment to these nutritional supplements or to placebo for a period of 5 years, and the 5 years will end as of December 31, 2017. So we're very close to the end, and we hope to have the results of the trial in early to mid 2018. We'll be looking at whether vitamin D and or omega-3s, because we can look at them separately as well as their combined effect, lower the risk of cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and a number of other chronic diseases. And we're also in the process of recruiting for the cocoa supplement and multivitamin outcome study, which will include 18,000 men and women nationwide. And it will test the cocoa flavanols, which are in cocoa products, and also multivitamins in the prevention of cardiovascular disease and cancer.
When a trial is going on, do you ever get to have a peek at how it's going, or do you have to wait till the whole thing is finished and analyzed before you can even see if there's a trend?
The researchers actually stay what we call blinded or masked to the study results until the end. However, there is an external and independent data and safety monitoring board, a group of experts and researchers who will review the results totally independent of the investigators and will check for safety issues, you know, be sure that there isn't clear evidence of any problem developing or risk to the participants. And also they will look for whether the study questions have already been answered. For example, if there's a very clear benefit that's emerged or a clear risk, then they may stop the trial prematurely, or they may recommend to the National Institutes of Health or the study sponsor that the trial be stopped early because the study questions have already been answered.
How are the participants chosen for these?
We have a number of avenues for recruiting participants. One of the most successful is doing mass mailings to members of the population using a number of lists, including subscribers to various magazines, showing that they have an interest in health-related issues. We also sometimes recruit through neighborhood health centers and hospitals, and we often will have some bulletins or advertisements that are placed about the study to inform the public that the research study is in active recruitment phase.
And how do you know that you have an even and fair distribution that reflects the general population? Because you're going to extrapolate the findings out to make recommendations that people will put in place later on.
The VITAL trial, which we know the composition in terms of demographics, age, race, ethnicity, body mass index, frequency of hypertension, diabetes, is actually closely representative of the U.S. population. It is a general population, of course, a little older because we limit the trial to those men who are 50 and older and women who are 55 and older. So it's middle adulthood and older adulthood men and women. So in terms of age, it's not totally representative, but in terms of other demographic factors, it's largely representative. But those who participate for randomized clinical trials and are willing to be in a long-term research study where they're agreeing to be assigned at random to either active treatment or to placebo and to spend time, you know, volunteering for the study and helping to get answers, they often tend to be a little more health conscious than the general population. But the VITAL trial participants are largely representative, and the COSMOS trial, we're still in the recruitment process, but we expect they'll be relatively representative of the U.S. population as well.
Dr. Manson, I want to revisit some of the topics we spoke to you from a couple of years ago when you joined us and see if any study results have come out since that time, which was probably in the fall of 2014. And tell us if there are updates in the thinking and recommendations on a couple of things. One of them that we talked to you about that I know you were very involved with is the idea of estrogen therapy being prescribed to help with menopausal symptoms, mainly hot flashes. What's the current thinking on that right now in terms of estrogen therapy for menopause?
The current thinking is that estrogen is the most effective treatment for hot flashes and night sweats related to menopause, and that women in early menopause, those who are within below age 60 and who are within about 10 years of the onset of menopause and who have significant symptoms, bothersome hot flashes, night sweats that can interfere with quality of life, that they are generally good candidates for estrogen therapy or estrogen combined with progestogen if they are generally healthy and don't have a particular risk factor such as a prior history of an estrogen-sensitive cancer or a prior history of a cardiovascular event. We do have a free mobile app called MenoPro, M-E-N-O-P-R-O, that helps to provide a personalized guidance in terms of whether a woman is a good candidate for estrogen therapy. It makes use of their underlying risk of cardiovascular disease and their risk factor status to provide some personalized guidance. And that may be helpful to listeners, but we do think that the evidence has now converged to suggest that estrogen is a very reasonable option for women in early menopause who have these bothersome hot flashes, night sweats, but there are also non-hormonal options for women. The good news is there are many other options besides and beyond estrogen. So if you don't want to take hormone therapy or you're not a candidate, talk with your doctor about the non-hormonal options available.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
And if you're just joining us, you should know that you're talking to someone who is involved in cutting-edge research. Joanne Manson is our guest. She's a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health, also professor of medicine at Harvard, and chief of the Division of Preventive Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Moving on, I'm curious to know, based on study results that you probably know about, there seems to be a little controversy within the medical community on the use of aspirin as a prevention of cardiovascular disease and cancer. aspirin could possibly cause bleeding in some patients, and it looks like the literature focuses on weighing the risks and benefits. Can you bring us up to date on what medical science advises at this point in everyday people taking a small dose of aspirin as a preventative measure?
Yes, aspirin is not for everyone. It's important to have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and not to have a high risk of bleeding in order to have a favorable benefit risk profile when taking aspirin. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has recently released guidelines for aspirin. Who is a candidate? We know that anyone who already has a history of heart attack or a stroke that was not related to bleeding, not the bleeding type of stroke, but what we call an ischemic stroke, or has a history of bypass surgery, angioplasty, already a history of cardiovascular disease would be a candidate. And in primary prevention, the preventive services guidelines are that using a CVD risk calculator, if you have a risk of CVD that is at least 10% over the next 10 years, and you're between the ages of 50 and 69, you may be a candidate for low-dose aspirin in prevention of cardiovascular disease if you don't have a high bleeding risk. So if you haven't had recent bleeding, you don't have a history of ulcer disease and significant bleeding. Again, there's a free mobile app you may want to try, which is not industry-sponsored. It's called Aspirin Guide, and it provides some guidance in terms of whether or not you might be a candidate for aspirin in primary prevention. So I think that overall, the evidence is strongest for those between the ages of 50 and 69, and it is recommended that you have a higher baseline risk of cardiovascular disease in order to benefit the most from a low-dose aspirin and not have a high risk of bleeding.
Just very quickly, though, what is the literature telling us about the prevention of colon cancer and taking a small dose of aspirin? Because I know that had been in the news at one time. What's the latest thinking as far as colon cancer or prevention of other cancers?
Yes, there is increasing evidence that aspirin, especially long-term aspirin taken for at least 10 years, may reduce the risk of colorectal cancer. And this is included in the latest guidelines from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, that that may be another benefit to consider with long-term use. And it's one of the reasons that the Preventive Services Task Force recommends that the patient be willing to take aspirin long term. If they're going to begin the process of taking aspirin, it may require a longer term therapy in terms of preventing colorectal cancer. And the recommendation is between the ages of 50 and 69. One of the reasons is that people in those age groups are likely to be able to live at least 10 more years and often many decades past that point.
One thing we've heard a lot about in the news in terms of medications are statins. Some people seem to think they are a godsend in helping people that are at risk or have risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Other people criticize the drug industry for pushing these medications on people whose risks really are not that great. What does current research tell us about statins?
Well, again, statins are appropriate for some but not all people. And again, as with aspirin, it seems to be based on the underlying risk for cardiovascular disease. So the latest guidelines from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology is that decisions about statins should be based on whether there's already a history of cardiovascular disease or there's a high baseline risk of heart disease and stroke. In this case, they use a cut point of around a 7.5% risk over the next 10 years of having a heart attack or stroke, and that can be calculated using one of these heart risk calculators that you can get through the American Heart Association or other sources. And also for adults who have a very high LDL cholesterol, such as 190 milligrams per deciliter or higher, they would be candidates for statins even if they don't have a prior history of heart disease or diabetes or other risk factors. So either having a very, very high LDL cholesterol or having high risk for cardiovascular disease based on a prior history, a high 10-year CVD risk score, or having a history of diabetes would be an indication for statin use.
Okay, we have 1 minute left, so we can't go into too much detail, but there were four things in particular we wanted to ask you. So if you could just tell us, for the person, the relatively healthy person that has done a little homework, heard about, let's say, vitamin D supplements for overall health, multivitamins, fish oil supplements, are these things we should be taking? I know there are studies that are studying them, but in the meantime, is there any reason not to take a multivitamin or not to add a vitamin D supplement in your everyday routine?
The jury is still out whether there are clear benefits for supplementation with vitamin D or multivitamins. Generally, the recommendation is to try to have a healthy, balanced diet and to try to get vitamin D and other vitamins through diet or reasonable amount of time outdoors, being physically active. There's some vitamin D synthesis in the skin. However, if you have bone health problems or concerns about whether you're getting adequate vitamin D from the diet, it would be very reasonable to take a supplement, 1,000, 2,000 IUs a day, no need to take mega dose supplements, and to take a multivitamin as insurance, as an insurance policy, to hedge your bets if you're worried that your diet is not balanced. But generally, the advice is to try to get these micronutrients from food and from the diet.
Dr. Joanne Manson is a professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's also professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School, and chief of the Division of Preventive Medicine, Department of Medicine, Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Manson, thank you so much for your thorough review of all the work that's being done.
Thank you. Good talking with you.